Okay. So the title of the talk was Whether We Live in Five Dimensions. There was sort of a joke when I was a postdoc at Berkeley that whenever a title of a paper was a question, the answer was always no. And usually that seemed to be the case, actually, if you read those papers. And here, of course, it seems pretty self-evident that we don't live in five dimensions. There's a substantial body of evidence, starting from thousands of years ago, that indicates we live in four dimensions. In particular, Newton was very aware of that fact. So you can ask the question why I'm even talking about it and why many particle physicists these days are talking about extra dimensions. So I'll try to give you a flavor of the reasons that we're thinking about it, both from a high and a low energy point of view, and tell you a few of the latest wrinkles. And I'm not sure how far I'm going to get in an hour, but I'll do my best. Okay, so first of all, why do we even entertain the idea of extra dimensions? Well, one reason is that, like it or not, string theory seems to work in 10 or maybe 11 dimensions. So once you accept string theory, consistent string theories as a given, then you have the fact that we do have additional dimensions. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that those additional dimensions are such that we'd actually have any evidence of them. They can be so small that there's actually no physical consequences that are possible to measure or see. But they're there, and so one would want to know how we would be aware of their existence and whether or not they give observable consequences. So basically, what are their effects? Where are they? Another reason you might want to entertain the idea of additional dimensions is that there are some problems in particle physics and cosmology that just seem very hard to solve in four dimensions. And most of them have to do with basically questions of small parameters in field theory. So basically, there's some sort of naturalness question having to do with why mass scales are what we measure them to be. Probably the most notorious among these problems is the cosmological constant problem, why we see energy densities of order 10 to the minus 4th eV to the 4th rather than M. Planck, which is 10 to the 19th GeV to the 4th. So that's what we expect. What we observe is many, many orders of magnitude less than that. And so basically there are some questions like that we're just stymied on. We just have not yet found a solution. Now, I'm not going to tell you that there's a solution to that in higher dimensions, but I will talk about a more tractable problem that actually seems that it might be resolved in the presence of additional dimensions, and that's the hierarchy problem. So we'll have a slight detour discussing the particle physics questions that we wish to address here, and the particular question we have is, we have the Planck scale sitting up at 10 to the 19th GeV, and that's basically telling us the scale with which gravity couples, with which the graviton couples, or the quantum gravitational scale. On the other hand, we have some relatively low energy scales in particle physics. We have lower scales than this even, but one scale is approximately the TeV scale, which is basically, roughly speaking, the mass of the W and the mass of the Z gauge bosons. So there are massive gauge bosons that mediate nuclear-type forces. And this is order 80 GeV, this is order 91 GeV. Together with the photon, these are constituting the electroweak sector of the standard model. And we know an awful lot about these gauge bosons. Their couplings and masses are measured very precisely. And so we basically know that this characterizes the theory very well, having a massive W gauge boson. These are charged plus and minus, and a neutral Z boson with these masses. But the question is how to make a consistent gauge theory that has massive gauge bosons. And that actually is a non-trivial question, and it was realized that it can be solved by something called the Higgs mechanism, the basic problem is that if you just had massive gauge bosons, if you tried to scatter together W gauge bosons, you find that the cross-section actually grew with energy, S being energy squared. And if this continued, you'd see that at high energies, your probability for scattering would actually exceed 1, which of course wouldn't make any sense at all. So a theory of just the mass of gauge bosons wouldn't be self-consistent. But it was realized there is a mechanism for giving masses to the gauge bosons in a self-consistent way, and that's the Higgs mechanism. And basically, the idea is that there's going to be some spontaneous breaking of a symmetry, which allows these gauge bosons to get mass by eating the would-be Goldstone bosons. So essentially, there's a symmetry breaking structure where SU2 weak times U1 is broken to U1 spontaneously through the expectation value of a so-called Higgs field. Okay. And the way this problem is resolved is that if there is a Higgs field in the theory, there's an additional scattering diagram in which the Higgs field is exchanged, and you'd find that at high energies these two diagrams would cancel and you would no longer have problems with unitarity. So we very firmly believe that there is some sort of Higgs mechanism. There should be some way of spontaneously breaking a symmetry associated with the electroweak symmetries with which these gauge bosons are associated. Okay. So that leaves us with the puzzling question of where is the Higgs? Really, Higgs. So just on general grounds, we know there should be something around that carries SU2 times U1 quantum numbers that's charged under the electroweak symmetry. So we'd like to have some field that's charged under the electroweak symmetry, SU2 times U1. We also know from the masses of the W and the Z gauge bosons and the gauge couplings, their gauge couplings, we know what scale this should be. And this scale should be about 250 GeV, which I approximated as a TeV here. Okay. So the key thing to observe is that this scale, the TeV scale, which is 10 to the third 3 GeV, is about 16 orders of magnitude smaller than the fundamental Planck scale in the theory. Okay. And the puzzle is, why should we have a scale that's a TeV, which is so much smaller than the Planck scale? And there's actually two puzzles. One is where this mass scale arose, but there's an even worse problem in some sense from the point of view of four-dimensional field theory, which is that if this Higgs field is a fundamental scalar object, okay, we find that it's very hard to keep its mass at 250 GeV given that there are additional mass scales in the theory. And in particular, if you had a Higgs gauge boson, you can have loops of any particle in the theory. So at higher order in perturbation theory, you find that even if you had set the Higgs mass to be about a TeV, it can't be consistently maintained at a TeV unless you keep fine-tuning at the level of 10 to the 16th each time at each loop level. Okay, so it's inconsistent without incredible fine-tuning. To have such a light Higgs. And that's truly one of the outstanding problems for particle physicists, because we're faced with a situation where we know a lot about the electroweak sector. We've measured it to incredible precision. We know that somehow the symmetry has to be spontaneously broken at this relatively low scale. But when we write down what we think is the simplest theory to do it, it just has this fundamental inconsistency in it. And part of the work of the last 10 years in particle physics has been trying to find a consistent Higgs sector that can actually address this problem of the hierarchy. The hierarchy problem is the outstanding problem that's motivated a lot of the work in particle physics today. And two of the key ideas were, first of all, to make the Higgs a composite. That's technicolor theories. And that's the problem there is that when it's a composite, it becomes a very high-dimension object, and it's very hard to get the whole theory to work in terms of all masses that you find for quarks and leptons and their associated properties. The other theory that's been quite well studied is supersymmetry to try to maintain the hierarchy. And I'm not going to go into detail on either one of those. I'm just going to tell you that both of those end up much more complicated than we would have liked, although one or the other might actually be the answer at the end of the day. But I want to emphasize that this was a problem that arose in the context of four-dimensional field theory, and in the course of this talk, we're going to talk about why in the context of higher dimensions we might have the possibility of stabilizing the hierarchy at a lower scale, okay? Namely the TEV scale. Okay, so that was a major motivation, and that's the one I'm going to focus on. One other motivation that I want to mention, though, is just the question of that it's actually a good idea to be able to know what we know. That is to say, we say that we test gravity. We say that it's obvious we live in four dimensions. But it's a good idea to ask, to study in detail, what are those tests? And suppose we alter the theory to permit higher dimensions, is it really true that they're ruled out? And by doing that, we also address the other interesting question, which is, if they are there, how would we look for them? So this allows us to say what will be the interesting test to know whether or not the other dimensions exist. It might seem a silly thing to do, because why should we try to complicate the theory when it looks rather simple? I mean, it seems pretty self-evident that we live in four dimensions, so why try to go out on a limb like this? Well, this reminds you that it's also obvious that the sun rotates around the Earth, and that certainly seems to be the simplest explanation of what we observe. And until you put in some other data, you really would be convinced that that's the best way to look at the system. But the facts that seem small in the beginning obviously really tell us that that's not the best way to look at the system. So it's a good idea to look for these small effects and see what they are. Okay. So that's it for motivation. Okay. So I'm going to now accept the fact that it's a fascinating subject to study and go on to say what does physics look like if there are extra dimensions. Okay. So I'm not going to directly address any of these motivations at this point. I'm just going to talk about how we expect physics to look if indeed there are additional dimensions out there. Are there any questions at this point? Yes.
So you're motivating more of extra dimensions basically as an alternative to supersymmetry. So does that mean you think it's totally unmotivated to consider supersymmetry and more extra dimensions?
No, in fact, they probably go together in the sense that probably the most interesting configurations are stabilized by at least some supersymmetry existing. So probably the ideas get tied together. The thing that you might get around are sort of so supersymmetry is really pretty nice, but supersymmetry breaking is pretty awful. So the thing you might be able to get around is low energy supersymmetry breaking, which is where the theory gets complicated. Are there questions at this point? Okay. So like I said, we're now going to assume there are other dimensions and just ask why we think that's ruled out. So well, first let's ask about the force law that we see, the gravitational force. So suppose we have some object with some gravitational potential. Force lines associated with it. And basically through Gauss's law, given radius, and ask how the force depends on the radius, and you see very simply that in four dimensions that force is proportional to 1 of r squared, and the coefficient of that force is g newton, which is basically 1 around Planck squared. Okay. Now suppose we were in a 4 plus n dimensional theory rather than a 4 dimensional theory. Well, I could draw the same sort of picture. Of course, it's hard to draw in the additional dimensions, but we can do sort of Gauss's law argument, and we see that we had a force proportional to 1 over r to the 2 plus n, 1 over m to the n. Okay. So that looks manifestly like a problem, because we see that gravitational forces would decrease far too quickly as we went to large distance scales. Okay. So how do we get around that? Well, one sort of obvious way that you might think of to get around this is that actually there are additional dimensions, but they don't have infinite extent. So in particular, let's draw this picture. Let's see what force would look like if we bounded one of these dimensions with some compactification scale, RFC. Then you'd see that at large distances, the force isn't going like 1 over r to the 2 plus n, but it's reverted back to 1 over r squared in the case that it's really a four-dimensional theory. And in particular, once you get to distances r greater than a compactification scale, it no longer has that option of spreading out. So in some sense, you can think that if you're an observer looking from very far away, you don't resolve this distance scale at RC. It really looks to you as if that other dimension doesn't exist. However, you would absorb it into the definition of what you called M Planck. Okay? So gravity would be spread out, but you're not really probing the fine structure at that distance scale. So you'd find that you could actually get a force that looks four-dimensional, but that your effective Planck constant would be renormalized. So you'd find that M Planck squared is equal to RC to the n times M to the n plus 2. And notice that if this is a large scale, you'd find M Planck is a big number, even if M is relatively small. Okay? But aside from that, you would think that this physics looks... And of course, you're just measuring M Planck squared at this point. You don't know anything about M, but you would see that this theory looks pretty much four-dimensional. Okay? Of course, once you begin to probe energies that are less than 1 over RC, or distances less than RC, you would begin to find some evidence that the theory was higher dimensional. But as long as you look from sufficiently far away, you physics should be safe. Okay. So from this, we would conclude that extra dimensions are okay, so long as the compactification scale is sufficiently small. And that's what you'd be led to conclude here. Okay. Okay. You could ask a further question, though, and you can say, suppose we live in what we think is a four-dimensional world. So we write down some effective field theory to describe four-dimensional physics. Okay. The question could arise, even if we're at low energies, do we have any evidence at all that there's extra dimensions in this theory? What are the effects of having these additional dimensions around? Okay. After all, you expect dramatic effects to occur when you cross this transition of energies of order 1 over RC. So at some energies below that, you should begin to see some effects of having additional dimensions around. Okay. I haven't talked about that yet, but yes, you're correctly anticipating what I find to be a problem with if you just put in a large scale to resolve that hierarchy. And that's precisely the question that we'll get to at the end. Good point. Okay. But for now, I'm not even talking about the hierarchy problem yet. I'm just talking about general consequences of physics of extra dimension. And we'll come to the hierarchy problem momentarily. Okay. All right. So now what I just wanted to ask is, what are the other effects? So far we've said the physics looks pretty much four-dimensional. Are there effects of having the extra dimensions? Well, in the four-dimensional effect of field theory, we expect that the effects should show up through some particles and their interactions. And in fact, there's a whole tower of particles associated with the existence of these other dimensions, and they're called the Kaluza-Klein modes. So the answer is yes, the physics of the extra dimension shows up, but it looks like what you have is a tower of states called the Kaluza-Klein modes in the four-dimensional theory that characterize the physics of the extra dimensions. In fact, we can learn quite a bit about those. Let's just imagine that we compactify in a circle here. So what are these particles? Well, one can imagine that there's some kinetic energy going around in this direction. These particles are moving around in the other dimension. Well, of course, if we're not actually seeing that extra dimension, you can ask how that energy shows up. Well, to us in the four-dimensional world, that energy would just show up as a mass. Okay? So what we see is a tower of massive states. And in fact, we know even more than that, because if once we do quantum mechanics, we know that those masses should be quantized. Okay? And that mass is quantized in units of basically 1 over RC. So you can think of that as sort of how many oscillations you get in some interval of size RC, where I've turned this around now. Okay? So we learn that the physics of the additional dimensions is characterized by light states whose mass m is quantized in units of 1 over r state in the simple picture. Spatial, yes. Yes. Okay.
What do you consider them to be time that people count?
Well, we talked about that after dinner the other, last week. But well, yes, it's actually an interesting question. We could talk about it. But I'm not going to do that here. Okay. What is the main problem?
It has been discussed various times. Aside from physical
representation. Instability. What kind of instability?
Negative energy. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because you're Hamiltonian, you'd evolve in one time and the other time would be outside your Hamiltonian. You wouldn't have positive definite.
Yeah, but the question becomes, what happens? Is there a sense in which you can compactify that, and what happens then? Okay, so that's sort of, if you just had the other time, it seems to be a problem. Okay. Okay. So let's just stick to the somewhat simpler case of spatial dimensions here. Okay, so then we say that there are these additional states, m, 4 to 1 over r. And now we can ask, what would be the constraint on the system? How big can I make these additional dimensions? Well, if this was the whole story, it looks like you'd have a limit on the extra dimensions that basically is associated with precisely this fact. For every state, there's an excitation of that state. So since we haven't seen, say, a partner of an electron, and we've probed up to energies of order TeV, you would naively conclude that RC would be less than 1 over TeV. Okay. Which is very, very small, some fraction of a millimeter, 10 to the 16th or something. Okay. So if that was the whole story, this would be it. Okay. But this is basically all by way of introduction, and I'm going to try to convince you now that the true story is actually much more interesting and somewhat more complicated. Okay. So this is the end of the intro. Okay. And now we're going to talk about what are the things that changes the story. And I think it's fair to say that the thing that really changes the story is basically comes about, again, somewhat motivated by recent studies in string theory, and basically it was the realization that string theory is a misnomer. So we have particles and then we have strings, but it's now realized that an important component of describing consistent string theories is the existence of membranes, so higher dimensional objects that exist at a fundamental level in the string theories. Okay, and I'm going to try to argue that it's the existence of these brains that changes the story quite a bit. And there are basically two reasons that this changes the story a lot. Okay, the first reason is that we now have the possibility of having brains and actually confining things like the electron to the brain. So we could have this extra dimension of size RC, but the electron doesn't necessarily have to propagate in the full extra dimensional geometry. Even though there could be many extra dimensions, n of them, it could be that the electron still thinks that it lives on this 3+1 dimensional plane. Okay. So if that's the case, it's obvious that you'll considerably weaken the constraints on RC, because the strongest constraints come from the particles that we measure well. The weakest constraints come from gravity, which couples so weakly. And in particular, if we put all the standard model particles aside from gravity on the brain, then the only constraints we would get would be from gravity, okay, in the bulk. And then we find that the constraint on RC has now gone down to 1 over 10 to the minus 4th eV, which is otherwise known as the millimeter. Okay. So this is a much, much bigger scale that we have here. Okay. So this is saying that one can be consistent with all known experiments on gravity as long as you put all the standard models stuck to the brain and only allow gravity in the bulk. Then we can permit the possibility of far larger dimensions.
Just to make sure I understand, in Joe's original picture, strings propagate between the brains, right? In the original string theory. Loops are strings.
Sure, yes. Sure.
So this is a different picture.
No, those loops are gravity.
But I thought those loops can be electrons as well.
Well, the electrons are only the
Okay, so let me just say, for I think the question you really asked, see, I can have a bunch of brains.
Right.
I mean, the way that gauge fields and particles get confined to the brain is that I sort of have a bunch of them living very close to each other,
mm-hmm.
okay? And there are open strings going between these, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That could be the gauge fields. But this is basically, I'm considering that all to be one brain for the point of view. That they're not spread out on the scale of a millimeter. They're spread out on the scale of some fundamental Planck scale.
Okay, so each of your brains.
Yeah, so they're sort of, exactly. I mean, of course, there's a possibility of putting extra matter in the bulk.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just asking what, just strictly from an experimental point of view, what's the biggest I can get away with for this extra dimension? And it's clear that the way I can get away with the biggest possible extra dimension is by putting as much stuff on the brain as I can and allowing only the things I have to put in the bulk in the bulk. And naively, it looks like gravity is the only thing that has to be in the bulk, so that's how I got that constraint. But there's all sorts of mixed possibilities. I'm not forced to do that. Okay. Any other questions at this point? It's a millimeter. It's basically the scale at which we've tested gravity. So gravitational experiments have gone down to a millimeter. They're basically approaching millimeter at this point. Okay. All right. So now let me go back to the hierarchy question that I mentioned earlier and ask, could this have any relevance? Okay. And some recent work says, well, maybe it is relevant because although it won't solve the hierarchy problem, it can rephrase the hierarchy problem. And what was the idea there? The idea was to say that gravity, that this scale is as big as it can possibly be. Okay. There are extra dimensions. This scale is big. It doesn't necessarily have to be as big as it possibly can be. It depends on how many extra dimensions I have. But the point is, what if M, this scale here, is of order TeV? And this scale is 10 to the 19th GeV. Now, why would I want to make the fundamental scale a TeV? Well, if the fundamental scale is a TeV, then all radiative corrections that I was worried about won't raise the mass anywhere beyond a TeV. That would sort of be like the maximal scale of the theory. It would be the scale at which the theory got strongly interacting. Effectively, the string scale of that theory would be a TeV, not 10 to the 19th GeV. Okay? So it would be a much, much lower scale, and we would stabilize the hierarchy. Okay? The trade-off for that is that in order to get a Planck scale this big, we had to spread out gravity quite a bit, because this number is evidently much bigger than that number. Okay? So we need to put in an RC that's big enough to get away with that. And in particular, if I had two extra dimensions, that RC would basically be that 1 over 10 to the minus 4th EV, which you notice is neither this number nor this number. So I'm putting in some extra scale in the theory in order to generate the hierarchy, and that was the issue that you mentioned earlier. Okay. But if I'm willing to do that, then I at least have a new phrasing of the hierarchy problem. And furthermore, if I've done something this dramatic to the theory, I now have ways of testing it. So whether or not you say this is crazy and unmotivated, you have definite experimental tests. Okay. So this theory can be tested. How? Well, through the existence of these light Kaluza Klein modes. Because if RC is so big, the masses of these Kaluza Klein modes are very small. So there are very light Kaluza Klein modes in this theory. Okay. And they're so light that they can be emitted, say, when some low-energy particles decay, like a kaon can decay into a pion with some emission of Kaluza Klein modes. Or even in stars, stars could cool by emitting these light Kaluza Klein modes because they're very weakly interacting. In fact, they couple with 1 over m Planck strength. You might think, how can something that has such a weak coupling, a gravitational coupling, be so important? And the reason is that there's just so many of them because they're so light that in any given energy interval, there's a huge number of them. So that when you put it all together, effectively, it's as if they were coupling with that m scale and not the m Planck scale. So although any individual mode is coupled only with m Planck, sort of effectively, it looks like they're coupled with a much stronger scale, namely that m scale. And then you get somewhat stronger constraints on the case of two extra dimensions just from looking at the physics of these light Kaluza Klein modes, stronger than the direct gravitational test. Okay?
So then you have to worry about cosmological density.
I'm sorry?
And that's okay? You have to worry about cosmological mass density. Contribution to the rho, to the cosmological mass density.
I mean, the question of how you do the
causal. So many modes. Do you have to worry about that? Or is it the theory?
Well, again, they're weakly coupled. So, yeah, so they actually have some somewhat complicated models of cosmology where the bulk isn't very well populated in the country. I should say that this is work that was done by Arkani Hamed, Demopoulos, and Jawali. And this isn't the work that Brahman Sundaram and I did, which I'm going to talk about momentarily. Okay. So you had to have a fairly complicated cosmology to accommodate these large extra dimensions. But you can, at least at low energies, which is all that we really, really know about. Well, they're not stable until one introduces a stabilization mechanism, and that's the question people are working on. Well, they're very light. So they can decay into each other. Oh, you're saying? It's true. Yeah. So it's somewhat like an axion decay time, which is very long. So it actually probably is stable on relevant scales, actually. Well, again, you have to ask when they were coupled strongly, and if they were in fact, you know, it's how they decoupled in the early phases of cosmology, as well, because they don't necessarily have the same temperature as everybody else. So there's complicated questions if you want to have a detailed story. Right. People are now addressing that question. I think stabilizing for a large distance scale is in fact very difficult. And that's another objection you might have to a large extra dimension. Why should it stabilize at this scale? So rather than address that question, which people are looking into, I should be fair, I'm going to talk about our more recent work where we actually have the possibility that it's not such a large scale, or a crazy idea, which is that it could be infinite, which is another thing that you might actually expect. So I'll talk about those instead at this point. Okay. Well, actually, we understand things, well, understand in quotes a little bit, but we understand how we can have a light electron. Electron is a fermion. Okay, so there are symmetries that can protect the mass of the electron, namely chiral symmetries, because it's a fermion. So we actually have so field theory, basically the only mechanism we have at our disposal is symmetries. But there is a symmetry that can protect the mass of the electron. Well, okay. But let me try to answer the question, and then I'll try. Okay, so there's two reasons. One is that it wasn't as bad a problem, but the other reason is that if you did it in that way, that would be essentially the maximal scale in your theory. So we actually know there are heavier objects, and we have to be able to explain them. And those heavier objects look fairly weakly coupled. We can describe them in perturbation theory. In fact, we've measured their couplings in exquisite detail at LAP recently. So you have to be able to have a perturbative description of the coupling of the W and the Z. And if you say the theory is strongly coupled at a little bit above the electron mass, you just can't do that. Okay. So we want to allow for all physics that we've measured. So the sort of baseline there is basically up to TeV. We basically can do perturbative physics, and it's been measured. Okay. All right. Okay. So that was the first effect of brain. Okay. So taking into account just this single effect that we can confine things to a brain, we found that the constraints, at least experimental constraints, are much weaker. Of course, we can ask what we think are good and bad scales in the theory, but that's a question of our opinion, whereas the experimental constraints are much weaker. There's another very important effect that brains can have in the theory, which is that if you have a brain, so let's say now plus one brain, and it's embedded in five dimensions. In fact, for now, let's say there's two of them. The brains themselves carry energy. They have non-zero energy density. So they themselves will distort the shape of gravity. So So in the presence of these brains, we won't have the simple sort of geometry that I've been implicitly assuming all along. So what I want to convince you now is that actually in the presence of the brain, you can have much more interesting geometries, where the graviton isn't simply just flat in this extra dimension, which was implicitly assumed in all those estimates I've been doing, but the graviton itself can have a very interesting shape. And in fact, the graviton can basically be bound to the brain, so that essentially one of these brains can see the graviton wave function as peaked on it. Okay. And in fact, I'm not going to go through it, but when Raman and I actually solved Einstein's equations in the presence of a brain, we also had a background cosmological concept. So I'll tell you precisely what we had. We had some cosmological concept. We had some brain energy density as well. Okay. And these were tuned to give a flat brain. And in the presence of this square root of lambda, which is I'm going to call k from now on, so this is basically minus k squared, we found that the background metric was not flat. Instead, it was very interesting. It looked like e to the minus, let's get rid of this guy. Okay. There was this interesting y-dependent factor that multiplied the metric, okay, the four-dimensional part of the metric, okay. So there's this. So instead of just being flat space, which it would be if there was no such factor here, we found that there's this interesting what's called a warp factor, okay, which effectively is a conformal factor so far as the four-dimensional theory is concerned. Okay. So this is what the solution looks like. And this factor actually has extremely important effects, as you might guess, since it has a very strong dependence on y. It's exponentially depending on y. Okay. So the question is, what is the physics of having that warp factor?
Why
is the coordinate parameterizing this extra dimension? Okay. Okay.
So the brain can be messy, right?
Yes.
So is this brain stable against fluctuations of the...
It is. Yeah. But we did need one fine-tuning in order to get a flat brain in the first place. But it is stable. Okay. So what are the physical consequences of this so-called warp factor? Okay. We've basically explored two of them. And as my introduction probably indicated, one that I'd like to focus on is the hierarchy. So let's again assume that I have this brain, and it forces this warp factor on us. But let's put another brain in, some distance away, which I'll call RC. Okay, and let me choose RC such that e to the minus kRC is precisely TeV over M Planck. Now, of course, I've argued that this is a very small number, or to 10 to the minus 16th, or 10 to the minus 15th, or 10 to the minus 16th. So that might look like I have to adjust RC incredibly. But notice that in the exponent, the number I'm putting in is only about 50. So I'm basically putting in the brain some reasonable distances away. Okay, I'm not putting in a very large distance scale here. I'm saying that somehow it's getting stabilized some reasonable distance away. Okay, but the effect of that reasonable distance away through this warp factor is that it's going to introduce a new scale in the theory, which is far lower than the original Planck scale that I was talking about. Okay. So in particular, whereas before we might have had some Higgs potential, which said that Higgs had to be minimized at B, and we said B was an unreasonably small number of order of TeV, 250 GeV. Here, the real parameter that's going to come in is going to be whatever the fundamental scale of the theory is, but But there's going to be some factor multiplying it, e to the minus 2ky. So the physical B, the one that's really going to determine the physical mass of the Higgs boson and its true scale of electroweak symmetry breaking, will be suppressed, roughly speaking, from M. Planck by precisely the right amount. And so here we have a hierarchy that's introduced exponentially. So we really didn't have to introduce small numbers. This really is a natural consequence of the background geometry. Question? Yes. Okay, so the important question, so basically we're aiming not to introduce small numbers. That's sort of our goal, is to try to have the numbers be as natural as possible. So we'd like everybody to be roughly the same scale. So if there is a fundamental scale of gravitational physics M, which is up near M Planck, we're going to choose all these parameters, all other mass scales, to be roughly the same. We're not choosing any widely deviating mass scales. So there's no unnaturalness in that. The one unnatural thing that we've done is tune this number, the brain tension itself, against the bulk cosmological term. And that's necessary to get a zero cosmological constant. So that's not a problem we're solving, and that is the one tuning we are doing. However, in the presence of that, we are naturally generating a hierarchy.
So this natural choice, what the RC, which is sufficient to make this
right, so KRC, which is really the dimensionless number parameterizing it, is roughly of order 30 or 50. It's not very big. Okay, so it's a pretty reasonable number. It's not a number that you might have expected to be exactly one. Okay. Okay. Other questions at this point? Okay. So I claim that this is an alternative way that we can use extra dimensions to address the hierarchy problem, and it actually seems fairly natural. An important question, of course, is can you test this? And again, you can ask the question, what would be the experimentally measurable indication of the fact that we had this extra dimensions? And again, the answer is the presence of Kaluza-Klein modes in the theory. Okay, so we have Kaluza-Klein modes. However, the Kaluza-Klein spectrum, as might be expected, is a little bit more complicated to find, because after all, we no longer have this simple flat geometry. And in fact, just like before, we could sort of understand what the modes are in terms of a quantum mechanics problem, namely quantizing the modes in terms in some finite interval or on a circle. Here we also have some quantum mechanics problem. Once we solve the quantum mechanics problem, we basically know what we need to know about these Kaluza-Klein modes. So the quantum mechanics problem that this turns into turns out to look like there's a shape P of y for a potential. And if we had the other brain ending the world, there'd be some boundary to this. Okay? So this potential, and we want to find the quantum states in the presence of this potential. Okay? This dip here is actually a delta function. Essentially, that arises because of the energy density on the brain. It's a delta function of energy at the brain location, y equals 0. Okay? And what you have here is a bound state. Okay? And that bound state is precisely the graviton. So the delta function supports a single bound state, and that bound state is the graviton. Okay? So to get the other physical effects, we want to find all the other Kaluza-Klein modes, and you can get those by quantizing in the presence of this potential. Okay? And that's precisely what we did. And in the case that the world actually ends at this location, RC, okay, so there were two brains separated by this distance RC, where I remind you KRC was about 50. Okay. What did we find? Well, we found that there are Kaluza-Klein modes whose mass, M, is roughly of order TeV. So the excitations, the additional masses, mass eigenstates, characterizing the additional dimensions, the spectrum basically doesn't start until you get up to a TeV in mass. Okay. So there aren't like Kaluza-Klein modes as there were in this very large dimension theory. There are only modes whose mass is basically of order of TeV. Okay.
You have some kind of spontaneous symmetry breaking that distinguishes one brain from the other. So if you apply quantum,
we actually do distinguish one brain from.
So you can actually tunnel in one brain.
No, we actually do distinguish the brains. One of these actually has positive energy on it, and the other has negative energy on it. So they're actually not at all equivalent. So that's why it knows to be bound on one brain and not the other. They actually are distinguished.
Are you not assuming boundary, the reality boundary conditions?
We're assuming orbifold boundary conditions, actually. Because these brains actually... Oh, it's periodic over a bigger interval, okay? So that's S1 minus C2, okay? So it's periodic over the S1. But I'm only giving you half the space when I tell you from here to here. It's actually another interval, and then it becomes periodic over that interval. Okay.
But this volcano is both sides, right?
No, it's only bound to the. There's a mirror copy here, but it's only bound in the middle.
Both sides. This thing on the right.
Right. It's only bound to the positive energy brain. It's not bound to the other, and so the potential is really. I mean, there's another little blip there, but that's not going to be important in solving a quantum mechanics problem.
I mean, are there reasons to speed all the ambiguous, typical periodic boundary condition or orbifold business? Do you have reasons to pick one out of the other?
To pick the orbifold boundary? Well, basically, the orbifold boundary conditions is sort of like reflective boundary conditions, so it's very physically motivated.
Why?
So basically, it's saying... Okay, so if you think of it, you have a circle, and you're identifying this point with this point, okay? So suppose I'm coming into this orbifold point here, okay? It's saying basically that I'm coming out, and then I'm identifying that. So in a sense, it's like reflective boundary conditions. So it's a fancy way of saying it. Okay. Other questions?
Give us some intuition how you get such a small energy scale from the quantum mechanics problem.
Okay, so I was going to focus on it, but I should spend some time saying that. Okay, so the point is, let's think about what we have going on. Okay, so let's just start from this brain, okay? So what you have is you have the graviton, and it essentially looks like it's bound to the brain. So the solution to the quantum mechanics problem gives me an exponentially falling graviton wave function. Okay, so psi for the graviton. It's going like e to the minus ky, okay? So effectively, the whole amplitude is centered here, okay? So if I live out here, I probe a very small amplitude for the graviton wave function. I say that to contrast it to the previous case where by having a large dimension, you basically had a large normalization factor. And so basically the amplitude is equally small everywhere. Here, the reason that we can get away without a large extra dimension is that because of the non-trivial shape, the amplitude is actually quite big if you happen to live over here, but it's really small if you live there. So another way of thinking what's going on, which is perhaps easier to understand, is that if you lived here, you'd say, oh, my strongly interacting scale is a TeV. All physical scales are a TeV, except for the graviton, which has this unusually weak coupling because its amplitude on our brain is so incredibly small. In fact, it's exponentially suppressed by e to the minus kRc. So that's another way of thinking about what's going on in this problem. You've induced the scale because the amplitude is exponentially suppressed. Okay.
What is the small parameter that allows you to give the entire story using the string theory? Why do you think they're not relevant?
Well, we have to take k a little bit less than m. So I said we're trying to make all the scales natural. But you can take k one or two orders of magnitude just so you can trust it. Well, we're choosing to do it in a regime where we can actually understand, believe the the gravity solution. So we take k a little bit smaller than m. Okay. 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 So I was discussing the Kaluza-Klein modes, and what I wanted to say is that we have these Kaluza-Klein modes of mass m of order TeV, and again, this helps to think of this picture. If you live here. Basically, you don't see any small parameters except for this exponentially suppressed coupling of the graviton. So a further consequence is that these Kaluza-Klein modes have a coupling that's basically 1 over TeV, which is interesting because you might have expected Kaluza-Klein modes to be coupled with their Kaluza-Klein modes of the graviton, their excitations of the graviton. You might have thought they had 1 over m Planck strength, and that's in the large dimension scenario, that is what happens. Here, they really have relatively strong coupling. Each individual Kaluza-Klein resonance has its coupling with strength 1 over TeV. I stress that because from an experimental point of view, that's extremely important. Because it means that you can collide together a quark and an anti-quark, produce one of these Kaluza-Klein excitations, and it's not just missing energy. It actually will decay. And it will decay inside the detector, say to an E plus and an E minus. Okay. So you actually have the possibility of discovering the extra dimensions by explicitly reconstructing spin-2 resonances, actually getting up to this energy scale and actually observing spin-2 resonances, which are the excitations of the graviton. So that would be extremely strong indication that you had this extra dimension, and this is the way it was working. Well, actually, on the scale of a graviton, this 1 over TV is a sufficiently strong coupling that it will decay in the detector. So it's pretty strong, actually.
This is sort of an energy just above the threshold.
Yeah.
If you go high enough, then the phase space for Kaluza Kleinmohr is going into other Kaluza Kleinmohr quantum.
Well, as you go to higher energies, the theory is going to become strongly interacting. You'll actually hit the string scale. So all hell's going to break loose at some point. So you're going to kind of move up in energy. You're going to see individual resonances, and then after that, you're going to see an ungodly mess that's going to be hard to interpret. Actually, the other polarizations aren't really there, at least for the graviton mode in this scenario. Okay, those are very heavy states, and they're not really there. So it really is the spin-2 resonances that you'd be looking for. Okay. So before I end, though, I want to so basically I've talked about extra dimensions, I've talked about their effects, I've showed you why it might be important for the hierarchy problem. But before I conclude, I want to tell you about some other interesting physics. Because after all, we've just said that the graviton is effectively a bound state in the presence of the brain. So if it's a bound state, that means it's going to be normalizable even if I get rid of this other brain altogether. In other words, I can allow RC to infinity. Okay, so I can really have this infinite extra dimension. I can actually have the fifth dimension be infinite in extent. Okay, and I still have a normalizable graviton mode. Okay, ordinarily, if I had said what would happen in a flat spatial dimensions, I would say that m Planck squared was equal to m cubed RC, and as I took RC to infinity, from a four-dimensional perspective, I would be decoupling gravity. Of course, that's just saying that gravity is fundamentally five-dimensional. However, we don't have that relation here. We have a bound state mode. Actually, if you compute what the effect of m Planck squared is, it's independent of RC as RC goes to infinity. It's actually determined by this parameter k. Okay? And that's relatively simple to understand by the picture we had earlier, because we said that the graviton is basically bound to the brain. Okay? So essentially, its whole amplitude is concentrated in this region, which is basically size k. Okay? So in some sense, this 1 over k is playing the role that the compactification scale would play. It's essentially saying the graviton is confined in a much smaller region than you would naively expect. The non-trivial shape of the gravitational background is effectively binding the graviton. I'll come back to that in a minute. What did you say? Yeah, that's right. Let's come back to that in a minute. Okay. So let me just first convince you that we can have an infinite extra dimension, at least as far as gravity goes. Okay. So at least as far as gravity goes, it looks pretty much like there's four-dimensional physics. And what's happening is that basically you would have naively thought there was far too weak a force if you just had fundamentally higher dimensional gravity. But you're adding something much stronger on top of it because this mode is so concentrated in the vicinity. Okay. Now, of course, to ask what the physics is, we have to address Tony's question, which is, where do we live? Okay. So a moment ago, I basically had another brain out here, and I said we lived here. And that was the end of the world, and we solved the hierarchy problem there by living there. Okay. We can actually have this same picture, and this is work I did subsequently with Joe Licken, where you have an extra dimension, but you live at the same location, RC. Okay? And you can ask, these are distinguishable. Well, in this case, you actually get a much richer spectrum of Kaluza-Klein modes. Okay? Going back to looking at the shape of the potential, you can see if I get rid of this other brain, which is quantizing things, okay, this potential actually falls off to zero. The effective potential of the analog quantum mechanics problem falls off to zero. So we actually get Kaluza-Klein modes that extend all the way down to zero mass. Okay. That was Rahman and my original observation, that we actually do have this rich Kaluza-Klein spectrum, extends all the way down to zero mass. The interesting thing, though, is that it's not as dangerous as you would have thought. You might have thought that would be completely ruled out by all sorts of gravitational experiments. The reason is that those Kaluza-Klein modes are coupled relatively weakly to people who live near y equals zero. Because you see, in the shape of this potential, there's this big barrier. Okay, so the amplitude to go in towards the origin is very suppressed. Okay, and actually, you find that if you live out at some scale y, the modes that start to oscillate according to living here are only those modes that have energy basically greater than the scale that you would have determined by living there. That's sort of a complicated statement, but let me just say it again. Let's define some mass scale E at some given scale y, E naught at some given scale y naught. Okay. I said earlier that we knew that modes would be quantized basically in units of that mass in the case where the world ended there. Okay. If the world doesn't end there, I have possibility of having modes, but they still don't start to oscillate until much further out. So they still look amplitude suppressed when I'm here. So I will get much stronger corrections to gravity than I would if the world actually was truncated there, but they're actually safe. And in particular, if I asked for what the gravitational force law was, I'd get a 1 over r squared term, but I'd also get some 1 over r to the 8th term. Okay. So I'd get something that's very sufficiently suppressed that it's not dangerous, but it's more tantalizing. It's getting closer because we now have all these other light modes. Okay. So what this means is that the physics in this scenario, in the infinite dimensional scenario in which I solve the hierarchy problem, is even richer. Because in addition to these Kaluza-Klein excitations at a TeV, there's all sorts of effects that you'd see at energies less than a TeV. You'd start to see corrections as I approach that scale. And that would be a sign that you have this much richer spectrum of Kaluza-Klein excitations, so extending all the way down to zero mass. I'm sorry, what's
so
the
point?
Yeah. There is no brain here. Okay, just let's just think of that as a perturbation for now. Suppose we just happen to live at that location.
We're not living in a big brain, but we just float.
It's like a test brain.
Yeah, so you can have a much weaker energy sitting on that brain. So let me just be very clear. So I'm distinguishing, let me distinguish three different scenarios, okay, before this gets out of hand. Okay, so there's one scenario, okay, which is two brains, okay, separated by RC.
Okay. And then we live on the one with the
U. Right, and we live on the one with the negative tension. So this one has positive tension, okay? This has negative tension, and we live here, okay? It's where we live, okay? Another possibility is that there's only a single brain, okay? We don't solve the hierarchy problem. There's an infinite extra dimension. We live here, and there's no hierarchy resolution. In that case, we get extremely weak corrections to gravity. We have this full spectrum of Kaluza-Klein modes. We don't introduce this tantalizing scale of a TeV. So as you might expect, all gravitational effects are weak, and they're suppressed by 1 over m Planck. So there are corrections to gravity here, but we just... So in particular, you'll get a force law that has 1 over r squared plus the 1 over r to the fourth correction, but the coefficient there is m Planck squared. So it's extremely hard to know about this extra dimension. This is completely in violation of your intuition, which is that as the extra dimension gets bigger, you should see more and more observable effects. Here we have this infinite extra dimension, and it's virtually undetectable. Okay. The third possibility that I mentioned is that we have this infinite extra dimension. We have a probe brain here, and by probe I mean that its effect on the background metric is relatively small. We have this infinite extra dimension, this brain isn't the end of the world, and it's a relatively small energy density living on it. Okay. We still solve the hierarchy problem here, but we get these more tantalizing experimental consequences where we begin to really probe this TeV scale. Okay. So those are three different scenarios. Okay. So I'm basically out of time, so let me just state a few conclusions.
What's the time scale for these experiments? How soon can we find out?
Well, these experiments, everything I mentioned is basically, it's not a gravitational experiment. It's a particle physics experiment.
Have they started these experiments?
So it's a scale of when the LHC turns on, right? I mean, it's going to be very 2005, if we're lucky.
How do you know that RC is properly functioning as a function of the rest of the domain? I mean,
right.
Can it kind of be a geometry and we have some regions?
So so there's some constraints in what that would happen. But the essential idea behind the physics is that there should be some stabilization mechanism. There should be some, say, a field that lived in between these two, okay, who gets some expectation value. So if I can describe some stabilization mechanism, that's the most likely possibility, if there really is a heavy field or any stable anything that's stabilizing that tension. Stable source of other possibilities, but you would get inconsistent in the sense that you'd be able to rule it out. So you essentially some stable. Give you some constant RC. And basically, you know, Poincaré invariance is preserved, so we better see that. Okay. So I'm not even going to write down the conclusions. I mean, basically, I hope I've convinced you that there's a lot of new and interesting physics in the study of extra dimensions. We've explored four-dimensional field theory. We see some limitations, and it's introducing some new possibilities. Some new ways of addressing, in particular, various naturalness issues that we have in hand. I haven't even begun to explore other possibilities, which are sort of astrophysical and cosmological consequences of having extra dimensions, which can't help but prove to be interesting since we've completely distorted the structure of space-time. Another interesting fact is that these theories that I talked about that address the hierarchy problem have effectively brought down the string scale and made it sort of an accessible scale. The string scale in these theories is very close to a TEV. It's a scale at which we see all the string resonances, and we begin to see those at a very low scale. So we basically see new effects. It has new ways of addressing the naturalness problems. And basically, the other exciting thing is that it can actually be tested. So for all these reasons, we think it's a fairly worthwhile pursuit.
But which experiments would rule out the stuff? What do we have to do to be sure
That's precisely the reason I said in the beginning, you want to know exactly what we know. Whereas before, you would have said, well, it's obvious. You just do gravitational experiments, and we rule out the existence of additional dimensions. In scenario two, what I just told you is that you can have an infinite extra dimension. You get extra effects that you don't see until you probe physics at basically the Planck scale. So you cannot rule it out, I would claim. At least we have no known way yet of ruling that out. Maybe when you explore cosmological consequences or something, more dealing with the gravitational structure of the theory, you'll see something. But purely from a low-energy particle physics point of view, that physics is indistinguishable from four-dimensional physics, which is quite remarkable.
Can you comment on the fact that you only want one bound state? If you actually look at the structure of the well rather than using the delta function, mm-hmm. is there anything you get learned of interest? So you only get one bound state rather than two.
I mean, basically, you know there's one bound state because you basically have a four-dimensional generally covariant theory, and that bound state is the graviton for your theory.
So people have. About the nature of the potential you have to
bind it. You mean, is there any way of probing the fact that the delta function is actually a little bit spread out on a string scale? I certainly don't know, because again, that's dealing with extremely high energy effects. So I'm able to explore the details at those scales, you might see something, but I don't know anything at this point. And people have actually, I should say, people have tried to do self-consistent kind of solid domain wall type solutions where things are spread out, and they find the same kind of physics. But you know, it's hard to probe new effects because, again, that's on the string scale or whatever.
So sort of the thing which is very basic perception is saying that the brain like, is dynamic and therefore has an energy density and therefore warps space and time. There are also these other series where the bulk is flat, right?
Yeah, that was what I talked about in the beginning. Most of our intuition is based upon having the graviton flat.
So it's completely reasonable to say that the brain has an energy density and therefore warps space around it. I mean, are you flat?
Oh, okay. So you're asking, are there any theories? Well, okay, so the answer to that probably has to do with the codimension of the brain. Because if you put a brain in, we had a 3+1 dimensional brain in 5 dimensions and it had a very dramatic effect. You might imagine that if you put that 3+1 dimensional brain in an 8 dimensional theory, the effects go down very quickly. So maybe in the immediate vicinity of the brain, you'd see some sort of non-trivial effects. But after you went some distance away, it would be a pretty good description
so
to say that it was.
Space,
yes.
Variable,
right, then you see the strongest effect.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Lisa, does this scenario have anything to say about the Hawking formation paradox?
I was hoping it would, but I think it doesn't. I think it's, the point is essentially, at the end of the day, you really are left with a graviton in your four-dimensional theory. So you have to, so basically you need holography to apply to that four-dimensional theory, just as if it was fundamentally a four-dimensional theory. Yeah, so you, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you go
right, I understand.
Yeah.
At some level, that's work in progress. But the naive answer is yes, because that there's the question is I'm throwing I live here on a brain. I throw the Kaluza-Klein mode out that way. Do I still feel its gravitational force?
Yeah.
And the answer is yes, because it does radiate. I mean, it is something that participates in the four-dimensional gravitational theory.
Yeah.
So it will leave a wake, I believe, of energy that knows about it. Yeah, so that's a dynamical problem of what happens to a heavy Kaluza-Klein mode. As it,
yeah.
Does it slow down? What exactly happens to it? And I don't know that, I don't know the full answer to that question, exactly what happens. No, at the end of the day, it better be conserved.
Yeah.
It's just a question of how it's all going to fit together to be conserved.
It's a little imprecise because of a certain uncertainty of the motion. In other words, momentum transverse to the brain is what we see as mass, right? The length energy. Whereas you're asking about a wave packet that you've localized in the extra dimension, and you're visualizing that wave packet moving off away from our brain, right? But that is, of course, a mix that's a superposition of various mass eigenstates. So every time you try and phrase this question very precisely, for example, you want to talk about something with a fixed mass, so you can run your paradox, you find that it's delocalized over the whole transverse state.
Right, but you can still ask for the back reaction on the brain. So, and that is a question that we're studying, basically,
well,
exactly how that does come back. At the end of the day, it has to be conserved. But how it's actually conserved is a subtle question. Because evolving the Kaluza-Klein mode, re-interacting with the zero mode.